This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
We're about ready to get started. So welcome, folks. So this is our first time to do this hybrid event. So thank you for your patience with the technology. So we've got folks who are have joined us via Zoom. And then, of course, you're here in person. So this is very exciting to kind of do all this with this technology. So we want to welcome you to this lecture on God as Gardener. It's part of a series that we're doing during the summer months to coincide with Father Chuck's sabbatical. He encouraged us to think about three R's: rest, recreation, and reflection. And so I put together a lecture series that features topics that are kind of a variation on the three R's. And so when I thought about recreation or recreation, of course, creation is the word that came up for me. And so I thought, what better person to provide a lecture for us than my good friend, Reverend Dr. Bob Goss. And Bob and I have been friends for, goodness, Bob, I think probably about 25 years now. We've published three books together, and we're working on a fourth right now. Bob has a PhD from Harvard in comparative religion. And he is a former Jesuit priest. He identifies as a Buddhist Christian. And his field is theology. And he's really concentrated a lot of his work in the last several years on environmental justice. And he has a couple of books that he's published, God is Green, and then The Insurgence of the Spirit. He is a retired United Church of Christ minister and is on their environmental justice team. And he's been working on a, and maybe he'll tell you about it here in a moment, but I can't remember the word now, but a statement that the UCC will adopt formally on the rights of nature. So, so Bob, I'm going to just turn it over to you. He's got some wonderful things he's going to share with us. There'll be time for question and answer at the end of his presentation. And for those of you who are joining via Zoom, if you would make sure that your mic is muted, because we're on the big speaker here in Crail C. So, so if, you know, if there's a TV or a barking dog or whatever, then we'll be able to hear it here in Crail C. So if you'd keep your microphone muted and then unmute yourself when we have time for questions at the end. So Bob, so welcome.
Mona, did you choose a reader for the Midrash I sent you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, let me get it. I'll read it myself.
Okay.
Excuse me.
So while Bob's gone, I'll just put in a plug for next week. So I hope you'll come back next week. I'll be lecturing next week on St. Teresa of Avila, talking about reflection, basically, or recollection. Hope you'll come back for that. And I'll give another plug. While we're waiting. After this series, I'm working on another series for the fall, the early fall, to coincide with the season of creation care and St. Francis Day. And I'm working with the Environmental Guild on that. And so we've got some speakers that we're lining up. Dr. Stephen Bishop will be one of those. He'll kick off our series talking about creation theology in the book of Psalms. So stay tuned for that as well.
Sorry for the interruption.
No problem, Bob. I'm sorry I okay. Missed that email. So
yeah, okay. I did want to do this in my office because it's too dark and I'm on my lanai at this point.
All right.
Several years ago, out of Australia, a biblical scholar, Norman Cabell, and a New Testament scholar, David Rhodes, started the Earth Bible Project, which is to learn to read the Bible from an environmental perspective, an Earth's perspective. So the reading I'm going to do, and they set out principles, which are really very interesting. And I'm going to do a midrash of the story of the Garden of Eden. A midrash is basically a sermon that tries to reveal truth within the reading. And you'll find that I'm telling the story, not from the usual perspective, but from the voice and narrative voice of the earth. And I think that'll launch us into looking at this from that perspective. On the day that God made the earth, I was born, and no plant or herbs of the field had yet sprung up, for God had not caused it to rain upon myself. There was no one to till my soil, but waters would rise from the ground and water the soil. Then God took some humus soil from myself and formed an earth creature. God breathed into the nostrils of the earthling, and the earthling became alive. I was so happy that a part of my earth body now walked upright and imagined and imagined that this earthling could till my soil. God planted a garden called in place named Eden. Trees and plants arose from the womb of the earth, and I marveled at what God was doing in my body. God is a gardener, for God planted every type of tree, figs, pomegranates, bananas, olives, almonds, and various nut trees, numerous fruit and berry trees, grapevines and ornamental and flowering trees adorn the grove of Eden. Communities of trees are a wonderful form of life, for they stabilize the weather and are useful for cycling water. They are intelligent and have been stable children. God loved planting trees and delighted in the garden. Then God brought forth streams of water called rivers to water the garden. The sun provided earth and nourishment to the plants and trees. God placed the earthling, Adam, in the garden, and each new occasion of creation, God gifted myself as God called forth new creations for the garden. We were embodied together as the soil community and all interrelated. God commissioned the walking earthling to care and serve the garden. And the walking earthling followed God in gardening, caring and tending the community of the soil. They learned to work together the abundance of life in the garden and preserve the community of trees, plants, and vegetative life and other life. One instruction was given: you may eat freely from every tree in the garden except from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the trees made from my body were not enough companionship for the earthling, so God fashioned from my body once more every animal of the field and birds of the air. They were siblings who walked over the ground and flied in the skies. They were kin to accompany the earthling, for they shared my body. Plants, trees, non-human animals, and birds, and the earthling are all my children. They were part of the soil community. The earth creature named all the non-human animals, but he did not find companionship. He sought. So God caused a sleep and took one of his ribs, and God fashioned the rib into a companion mate. Thus God created them male and female, and they were given responsibility to care for the God's garden community. A wise serpent asked the woman, "Did God say, you may eat the fruit of any tree in the garden?" And the woman answered, "God says that you may not eat the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch or you will die." The serpent replies, "You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, you will be opened and your will be like God's." The woman saw the tree and was good for eating and delightful and desired the fruit. She ate and gave some to the man who was with her, and he ate as well. Their eyes were opened and knew that they were naked. They separated themselves from the non-human animals and fashioned coverings, fig leaves. At the time of the evening breeze, they listened to God's coming presence and hid themselves. God says, "Where are you?" And the man says, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and hid myself." God said, "Who told you you were naked? Did you eat of the fruit of the tree which I instructed you not to eat?" The man blamed the woman, and the woman blamed the serpent. Since they ate the fruit from the forbidden tree, they lost all community with the plants and the trees and animals. And the earth lamented, "Sadly, they lost all connectedness to myself and their siblings. They forgot their humus origins, and God placed them outside of Eden to learn how to connect and reconnect to the earth community once more. Humans forgot a deep truth that the soil that all life shares, a common ancestry from the humus or the soil, and are a part of the community of my body. And I wept at the trees, at the loss of my earth children. God comforted me with hope. One day there will be a new earth creature born within from the soil. He will be born from a cave tomb in a garden and become a great gardener, carrying out the mission of his parent who loves gardening. He will instruct humanity on gardening once more, and they will return to the community of the soil and once again learn all forms of interdependent community of the soil. Hope was born once more in my dreams." Okay, that's kind of not a normal reading, obviously, and it's from the perspective of the earth. But one of the things the Earth Bible does is try to foreground the earth and other nature elements. And so out of this project came the Seasons of Creation, which I recommend that you might think about, which every September is four Sundays that celebrate creation in various ways, the rivers, the mountains, and so on. And it ends with the fifth Sunday in most of the times in October, which is the feast of St. Francis Assisi. And the blessing of companion animals is one of my favorite things doing. Everyone loves St. Francis. I've been in pet shops, stores, blessing animals, and Muslims and Jews and indigenous people all love St. Francis. And so that's one of my favorite occasions. But I wanted to stress this because this is a story not of the past. I think it's really not practical to say that this is a historical, literal story, but it's a story about us in the future, that we have lost connection to the earth and we need to be restored. One of the things that I started thinking about gardening, and I have thrown up a picture of one of my favorite heroes, and he is Thomas Berry. He is a Catholic priest that died in 2009, but he has basically really started the ecology and religion movement. And he's written a number of books. The Dream of the Earth is fabulous and worth reading. But he also basically, with his disciples, basically had at Harvard a four-year series on every world religion, which was to retrieve the green and ecological aspects of the earth and the environment within those traditions. There are 10 books, all averaging about 500 to 600 pages, with some of the best scholars in the world really looking at ecology and trying to kind of really place religion and spirituality within that framework. He says something about gardening, so I used it. "Gardening is an active participation in the deepest mysteries of the universe." He says that basically that creation is not a collection of objects, but a communion of subjects. And that is one of the basis that Mona alluded to. I came to work on putting together a resolution about a year and a half ago with the United Church of Christ on the rights of nature. It came out of my writing, The Insurgency of the Spirit, looking at indigenous rights and human rights and nature rights. And it's gone through all sorts of hoops. And this week I have four groups of delegates to go through and a committee that will be the final vetting. And then next Sunday, and I ask your prayers for it, I hope it will pass. I think it will. And the United Church of Christ will become the first Christian polity to declare that legal rights of nature. And the you can Google the resolution. It is, "Who will speak for the trees?" And you'll find it at this point. But it's there, and it's important because I think we're losing the war to save the earth, and we need to do some dramatic actions to reverse our patterns. But today I want to talk about gardening, which is one of the famous things that I like doing. I've done this for several garden groups of disciples and UCC and other churches, Episcopal churches too. And gardening is really a very important spiritual practice. In LA, which I'm going to show you several of my favorite gardens, the Episcopal bishop asked every church, Episcopal church in the diocese, to use all excess land space and even lawn space and convert them into gardens to grow vegetables, to really bring those vegetables to the food banks of LA, because there we have a real issue in terms of food inequity and et cetera. They also have, very interesting, a labyrinth made from spices and herbs on the side of the hill right next to the building that houses the cathedral. But I really applaud that. And I also applaud another Episcopal church I didn't have a chance to visit. It's called the Church of the Woods. Another thing to Google. It's a Episcopalian church that bought 150 acres of forest and wetlands. They divested of their church. Their church is the property of 150 acres. And they have Sunday service in the forest. Now, my problem is I don't like cold. And in winter, they put up a tent for holding services. But it is an attempt to kind of really say that there is a, we need to bring nature into our churches because it is sacramental. The spirit has been in nature and creation from the beginning, and it is also a retrieval of the full incarnation of the cosmic Christ, that the incarnation has deep roots in life and earth life. So my first one is the Hannah Carter Japanese garden, and it's very lovely. It was a Japanese garden that was willed to UCLA, and I like Japanese gardens because of what they say and don't say. There's a simplicity there for meditation, some colors there. The stones are done correctly and they represent kind of an emptiness and so on. But there's a beauty there, a very simplicity that when you are there, you're kind of quiet and attentive to what's happening and you listen. Here is the Huntington Gardens, which is in Pasadena, outside of LA. It is a huge complex of various different types of gardens. And again, here is the Japanese gardens. I gravitate that because I like Zen practice of meditation and attentiveness and mindfulness. And here is one of their gardens. I'll show a couple other landscapes because they have very different landscapes and you can spend several days going through. They're basically desert landscapes. I did not really care for desert landscapes until I moved to LA. And the gardener basically created a whole section of desert landscapes and basically cacti. And I became fascinated at the beauty and the flowering, et cetera. And even things that I thought were not so beautiful turned out to be simply absolutely wonderfully and amazing. Another episode of the Huntington Gardens. You can see colors and amazement there, and even the artistry of God as creator. God is an imaginative creator of art and beauty and amazement. And these are ways that we can connect in a very tangible way with the revelation that God has given within creation. There is an original gift there. If we just take a moment to realize that every time when I walk in the garden, I breathe out carbon, they breathe out oxygen to me. And there is an interconnection of plants and humans together as a form of a community of life. I am not above these plants. I am part of that community of life. And that's what the Earth Bible Project attempts to bring at, really, that there isn't human exceptionalism. We're part of God's community. And it basically restores, I think, a balance that I am a creature. So when I speak theologically, I'll speak of human animals and non-human animals to really link the fact that non-human animals are connected to us. And it's interesting, the studies that I started getting into, when I started this first presentation, I didn't understand that trees speak. Google that, how trees speak. There is a phenomenal thing of mother trees in groves of trees that nurture their saplings. And when there is stress there, they send chemicals through the fungi in their roots and rhizomes to feed and connect and overcome the stress. There is an intelligence there and a language there. And to me, they're wonderful stewards that human beings could take lessons from. Now, taking this idea of gardening and knowing that you have Anglican roots, and Julian of Norwich is not only is a favorite of my husband who has studied her, but also a favorite both in the Anglican Church as well as in the Catholic Church. And she has this passage, "For I saw the Lord sitting like a man. I watched wondering what kind of labor it could be that the servant was to do. And then I understood that he was to do the greatest labor and the hardest work there is. He was to be a gardener, digging and ditching and sweating and turning the soil over and over to dig deep down and to water life, water the plants at the proper time. He was to preserve in his work and make sweet streams to run and find plenteous fruit to grow, which he was to bring before the Lord and serve him to his likings." In the 12th, 13th century, or the time of Julian, it was very common, and you can find them still preserved in some of the museums, that altar cloths were basically stitched with the image of Christ the gardener. And we'll come to that. But I think that there's a spirituality that of gardening that I think it's important to recognize and maybe appropriate as a way of looking how we relate to the earth. As I said earlier, the Garden of Eden is a mythic projection of God's grace space for a future ecotopia. For we are alienated ourselves from the garden of the earth over the last centuries. There is perhaps more truth in the myth for contemporary humanity as we have further disconnected ourselves from nature and gardens. If there is an original sin, which I do think humans have foibles, and that is the myth that we are exceptional. We're removed from creation, that we're above creation. This is called anthropocentrism, that we're the center of everything. You see that in the exploitation of nature that is rampant within our society today and the devastation we're doing to nature. And I grieve so badly that what's happening on the West Coast with the fires and now the drought and the effects upon the earth, the type of gardening we do in the Midwest and the depletion of topsoil. And here in Florida, one of our churches is really facing sea level rise. And a couple of weeks ago, Miami has decided to build a 20-foot wall around Miami against sea level rise. These are real issues confronting us. And we have to kind of observe this and say, what is our responsibility to do and care? I think human pride, exceptionalism, greed, all function to basically devastate the earth. And I ask you to think that, not for yourself, but think for your grandkids and their descendants. What kind of earth is going to be left to them? I grieve so deeply. I want to spend the rest of my life really working to green churches and to really help the religious environment movement become viral and exercise things. Our kids are speaking up. You look at the college students and even Greta Thunberg, you know, she's a real great prophet, but there are lots of kids that are doing likewise. And in New Hampshire, in a neighborhood town, there was a 20-year-old student every Friday would go out and even in the coldest of cold days and have signs calling people to remember the care for the earth. She's going to get an award from the New Hampshire Environmental Justice Council. for her work. I think these are important things for us to recognize, that we've got to really work with our children on this. The 21 kids from ages 9 to 21 have sued the U.S. government under the Trump administration for the right to have an earth where they can breathe and live. They've gotten, not dismissed, but they've gotten basically still in the process, and it's a very slow litigation. But they're saying something to us adults. What have you done to the earth? We have to kind of look at that and take that serious. A relationship is established in which the garden silently communicates its needs and desires. Any good gardener knows that there is a genius particular to each piece of land, which will determine what will flourish. Our best gardeners operate not as masters over their garden, but as one intelligent source of creativity among others, centers of creative intelligence, the plants. There's growing research talking about the subjectivity of plants. A book that just came out, very profound philosophical book, talking about plants as persons and intelligence. Boy, that throws things up. Just as our research on animal life, human, non-human animal life, that basically they do have intelligence. There's even studies suggesting that meditation as a practice was practiced by chimpanzees. And so do animals have a spirituality? And I would say yes. One of my dogs has taught me how to meditate in the garden. And I've heard this from other dog fans, that when they go on walks, they learn how to meditate by watching their dogs and being attentive to nature. Good Zen practice. Now, I bring up Emily Dickinson because I do talk to her about her in the book, The Insurgency of the Spirit. She liked to skip church on Sunday. And her rationale was her garden was her church. She said, some of the best sermons I ever heard were in the garden, even the best music, etc. And she wrote a couple of poems about the garden. You can see gardens in New England, and they're very fragile in some ways and so transient, because they come up in maybe about the second week of June, and they last maybe till the first or second week of September. They have a short growing season, but there is, as you can see in the picture, there are fabulous blooms of color and growth there. And so I can understand her finding amazement and wonder there. And especially in New England, there are lilies that grow everywhere, not only in gardens, but on the roads and sideways. So lilies were a very important part of her. And she basically said, you know, consider the lilies of the field was the only commandment I ever obeyed. Okay. What does she mean by this? Well, when we talk about the lilies of the field, we look at them and we see that they do give praise to God in their shooting out and thriving and giving us a sense of beauty and wonderment and even the process of creation. And so I would say, yes, I agree with what she says. And I think that she basically was attentive as a poet. And I would say that the basis of all forms of meditation is an attentiveness. I've had college students go out and spend time in nature, and I asked them what they do. They said I kind of chill and just observe and listen. And I said, right, they're doing the kind of preliminaries of meditational practice. Really important. I think it's really important, and that's why I spend some time on gardening, because if we fall in love with nature, we're going to fight for God's creation. And I have that on every email that goes out. I basically believe that we need to fight for God's creation, because the forces are so overwhelming, what we're doing to killing. I mean, for instance, I've always, when I was in LA, I could not understand why you would frack in an earthquake zone and create other earthquakes. I mean, look at Oklahoma. And the fact that the aquifers are poisoned. Look at the amount of water that would be able to be provide California through the aquifers that were not poisoned. You know, I look and shake my hands at this senseless and short-sightedness of greed over really learning to garden and listen to nature and take it seriously. Jay McDaniel has something to say about Lilly. He says he's a process theologian that graduated from Claremont School of Theology with a doctorate and lives in Arkansas, so he's not far from you at this point. And he says, but the lilies also have something important to say, not in words, but in sheer presence. In their naturalness and spontaneity, in their receptivity to the breath of life, they embody the heart of spirituality. They find God in the present moment. And they find connectedness to us because we and plants interbreathe. That's a beautiful concept. We interbreathe. And we also interbreathe, all of us, with the spirit. For Dickinson, there was an interrelating with lilies in our garden with God's presence. There is a correlation with McDaniel's practice of mindfulness and Dickinson's poetic attentiveness. They overlap in similar approaches. Now, here's a gardener, and I dedicated God is Green to him. Greg was director of a number of opera companies, and he came down in 1996 with HIV, pneumocystis. And so the chair of the board fired him while he was on a respirator. Greg came to the church at one of the funeral I was doing and never left. Greg lived with HIV, AIDS, and he counted his T cells less than 100 and came to garden every day. He fought off cancer. I would say the garden kept him alive, and he admitted that. And one day he sat with me and said, you know, I grieve every time a plant dies, but then God surprises me. The plant comes back. He says, I think that's what God is going to do to me as well. And he said, I have to say that as I listen to the garden, I have become a wonderful deacon learning how to listen to people. And I'm saying, yes. That was one of the points that made our church do something very radical. We made the earth a member of our church, therefore it became the largest church in the world. But that meant that we had to make a commitment to the earth, and we did by making a covenant and required that pastoral care had to take place for the earth and all life. So that became our orientation. We put solar panels on our church. We started to harvest water in a drought, and somehow the Spirit, kind of with a sort of serendipitous way, we put a rain barrel that was hooked up to our air conditioning units. Guess what? We got over 100 gallons of water every week and a half to water our gardens, and we had the lowest bill for watering in LA. And everyone loved coming to the garden itself. The 12-step groups, people would congregate, people would just come and sit in the garden. My dog would like to climb up on the table there and just kind of enjoy things. And he meditated as well. But Greg taught me a lot about that there is a relationship, not of hierarchy between gardener and garden, but an interrelationship of really equals, learning and helping one another. And think about that. The idea of stewardship doesn't really work because it is a mastery over. It is a model that comes out of the kingship model of running the grove for the king. Gardening is more hands-on. And if you go back to that original story of God as a gardener, God gets God's hands dirty in the garden, in gardening. And I saw basically a real gardening saint in front of me, and I treasure his life. He died 4 years ago, and I grieve at his loss. What I call something is biomimicry, and this is a fancy term, but biomimicry says that we can learn things from the earth. One of the gifts of biomimicry is that you enter into deep conversation with organisms and this student-elder dialogue, elder being nature itself, the plant itself, absolutely fills you with awe. Instead of seeing nature as a warehouse or a thing, you begin to see her as a teacher. Instead of valuing what you can extract from her, you can learn from her. And I say this because I think it's important for us to recognize that nature is not an object. Indigenous peoples in an ethnobotany botanist out of the University of Wisconsin. She is from the Anishinaabe tribe that is fighting against Pipeline 3 in Minnesota with the protest. She wrote a beautiful article. I can send it to Mona and she can forward it to you. We have to stop thinking of nature as a net. She said we need to have new pronouns for, and she suggests ki, K-I, for the singular, and kin for the plural. So I use that. I sometimes use it for myself when people are sharing pronouns, just to kind of get them to talk about it. But it points to the fact that we need to think of nature not as a commodity, a thing that benefits us, but a relationship. God-given, an original gift. Norman Winsbaugh, he has a book called The Restoration of Paradise, and he's a professor at Duke. He's also Google him. He's got a couple talks on YouTube, and really good. He says, gardens are places where people learn that death is not simply an end to life, but a vital ingredient and partner in furthering life. I think for us, it's really a place that we can encounter our mortality and recognize with faith that it's not our end when we pass, and not to be afraid of passing. A simple thing to say, but it's a complex thing emotionally for many folks who are in the process. I'm fighting off a really autoimmune disease that I'm living on with a immunosuppressant at this point in time. And it reminds me that my garden reminds me that life continues on. The God of life is there. And I have confidence coming from engagement there. The second truth about gardens is that they become a second nature. Nature interpreted, landscape cultivated, built upon, transformed in innumerable ways. Sally McPhee, who is my all-time feminist hero ecologist, she endorsed God as green. She says, she repeats an insight that the second nature of gardens is an improvement on the transformation of nature. When I asked her for endorsement quote, she gave me, and she said, your thoughts are exactly on target. She was a Methodist Episcopalian, kind of both at this point, but she practiced meditation. I knew that after I read her theology, that she was a deep thinker that connected nature. And one of the things she said, you know, I'm not sure I did enough. I came back to her and said, well, you radicalized me. I have been radicalizing students and parishioners for many years. So look at that and look at that trajectory. And I'm sure that other students as well have carried on the insight and struggles that you've had to recognize that nature is something that is valuable. Dorothy Frances Gurney writes, one is nearer God's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth. You know, there's so much truth in that. I asked folks on for Lent to adopt a plant and to listen to the plant for 40 days and then share their insights. I also encourage people on Holy Saturday, it's between Good Friday Tenebrae service and Easter sunrise service, to go to a botanical garden and walk that garden very attentively and listen to life. I think it's really important for us to understand the mystery of death and life, and it's engaged as we go and experience a garden. The Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw says, the best place to see God is in a garden. And I would agree. I go out in the morning and with my coffee into our garden, which we went overboard and planted about 16, 17 trees and hundreds of plants. I can't show it to you because I don't have a means of doing that, but it's a place where I find God really well, and I listen to the plants, I water and care for them, and I learn from them. Daniel Hillel is a biblical scholar. He says, the ancient Hebrew association of man with soil is echoed in the Latin name homo, derived from humus. The stuff of life in the soil, the powerful metaphor suggests an early realization of a profound truth that humanity has since disregarded to its own detriment. Since the words humility and humble also derive from humus, it is rather ironic we should have assigned our species so arrogant a name as Homo sapiens, wise men. It occurs to me as I ponder our past and future relationship to the earth that we might consider changing our name to a more modest Homo sapiens curans, which is the word curans means denoting care, caretaking, curator, we get out of it. T.S. Eliot says that teach us to care is so important that compassion is really a way for us to connect with nature and listen very deeply. Okay. God is gardener. Let me get into this. This is from writing from Carol Epic. And to me, this is my image of God. I will now tell you how to recognize a real gardener. You must come to see me, she says. I picture God as a woman. I will show you my garden. Then when you go just to please her, you find her rump up in the air, sticking up somewhere among the perennials. And she says, I will come in a moment. She shouts to you over there. Just wait. I have a plant. I've just planted this rose. Please don't worry. You respond kindly to her. After a while, she must have planted it, for she gets up and makes her hands dirty. And beaming with hospitality, she says, come and have a look. It's a small garden, but wait a moment. And she bends down over a bed of weeds and some tiny grass. Come along, I will show you Dianthus musella. It will open your eyes. Great Scott, I forgot to loosen it here, she says, and begins to poke in the soil. A quarter of an hour later, she straightens up again and she says, I wanted to show you that bellflower that is the best campanella, which, wait a moment, I must tie up this delphinium. You know, that's a perfect image of God. With a big brim hat in the garden and with kind of doting over creation. I think that to me, that is really says a lot about God. One of the great mysteries is Edward Eklund, who's basically a European environmental theologian, interprets this gospel scene with John, of Mary initially mistaking Jesus as the gardener, as a profound irony with many connotations. Jesus, in fact, is the gardener, the new Adam, as the open side of the cross intimates. Master of garden earth, the one in whom, with whom, and under whom all human gardeners garden. I think that's really wonderful. I've always enjoyed that story, and the vocation to become gardeners comes from the fact that Jesus is resurrection is birth from a tomb in the soil. Likewise, biblical scholar Mary Colos confirms Eichlin's early observation. Mary's perception that Jesus is a gardener is accurate. The risen one has passed through a death into glory that was originally his with God in the beginning. He returns to Mary as the divine gardener walking in the garden of creation. Boy, you could spend time on that in conversations. There's so much there. Okay, I'm getting to the point where I just want to, I'll ask Mona to make the PowerPoint present to you so you can go through the rest of it. You know, I would say there's a Christian vocation of gardening, and it has contemplative benefits of slowing us down in the modern world, become aware of our ecological location, life surrounding us, and taking appropriate action for eco-justice. As we become habitual gardeners, we have to become gardeners in the world and become earth-centered and less egocentric. So in that regard, so my advice to you is pay attention, garden, just be in the moment. There's an example of the Buddha in mindfulness. And there's mindfulness is spelled out as basically moment-to-moment attention. I is here and now non-judgmental attitude, detach us from unhelpful thoughts, forgive and be grateful, unconditional acceptance, learn with childlike mindset. These are the things that we need to cultivate to live in this world responsibly and to restore right relationship. Aldo Leopold, who is the father of basically in environmental studies, wrote an almanac, the Sandy County Almanac, which I've discovered so many people would read on a yearly basis as a Bible. And I met a gentleman who was in his 80s who said, I read it as a Bible, and I take notes and observations every day on what's happening in nature. And he pulled it out and he started reading them to me. He was practicing form of meditation by observational connection and understanding. He saw and he also grieved at the loss of species and what species were still alive. He worked hard along with that church, with the Miwok indigenous people in Sonoma County to restore a wetland in which church members have become docents there. And I took a whole field trip of an annual gathering of UCC folks at their annual gathering, an afternoon off to go through the wetlands to experience and find God and relish nature. So I'm sorry I had to rush through that, but I think it was important to at least get to the last part. So I recommend God is Green. It's fun. It's not too hard. Mona can help you through it. Okay. Let's open it up to questions. We still have some time. We have at least 10 minutes.
I don't have a question. I just so agree. I'm interested in, you were saying stewardship. I constantly sign tons of petitions saying we are called to be good stewards of this earth and all the creatures in it. Well, maybe it's more than that. Maybe I'll say we're called to be gardeners.
Yes, but, I agree with you. I do that too. I correct people on stewardship and just say, you know, let's think of ourselves as gardeners. We're not above the garden. We're learning from the garden as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the important thing. There's a reciprocal relationship there that we have to give credit to. And it really inspires our sense of spiritual journey. But it's a spiritual journey that is not alone. Nature is with us. Nature is not a thing. Nature is a subjectivity. You know,
The more I see of the intelligence and compassion of and meaningfulness of animals. I've always loved animals, but in the 4 years I've lived in this brand new home that had nothing in the backyard, I have this lush backyard now with wonderful butterflies and birds and hummingbirds and lizards and plants. And it means so much to me. And so now I know it's more than just gardening. It's a spiritual life. So thank you for all the comments. Yeah.
And it's also reminding you that you're part of that community of life, the web of life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
And that is being endangered very dramatically at this point.
So now I'm going to go stick a sign in my front yard that says, take care of Mother Earth so she'll take care of you.
Yeah. I mean, any Thanks. Other comments or questions?
Hi, this is Jane again. I was wondering, you just referenced Sonoma and the gardens, and I'm actually out in Petaluma, California, and I was wondering, what is the name of that place, and is that somewhere that I can go and visit?
It's actually in Petaluma.
Oh, my goodness.
It's the garden across the river there, and the church my husband was interim was the UCC in Petaluma up on the hill.
Okay.
And so the high school students, the Miwok, and the church itself all work together to restore the wetlands and restore nature to it. It may not be originally the way it was, but it's full of life and it's wonderful to kind of visit and walk through. It's really delightful. So yes, do that. I mean, it's a great place.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. If you don't have any other things, I will tell you that from this kind of notion that we are basically citizens of the earth, that we are siblings, which goes back to St. Francis of Assisi, his Canticle of Canticles. And basically he has a notion of a biotic community of siblings. And that I think it's really important. And he was ignored as a solution in the 1968, there was a scholar at UCLA, Lynn White Jr., who, and I write about him, he was a son of a Presbyterian minister, and he wrote a pivotal prophetic article on the origins of the ecologic crisis in 1968, and blamed a lot on Christianity's interpretation. And that was one of the, you know, to dominate and conquer the earth and subdue it. And that is certainly a trajectory that has been used. But he suggested a solution, and that was to adopt St. Francis of Assisi and Albert Schweitzer as models. And that was disregarded by many Christian leaders. They called him a communist. They demonized him. I felt there was something there, and I followed more of his writings. And he talked about compassion as a way of connecting with the earth, as a way of being attentive and working for it. And I said, okay, my Buddhist radar is going off. I had to do even further explorations and discovered that as a 16-year-old, he was traveling in Ceylon at the time, now Sri Lanka, and he came across a road construction with a Presbyterian construction manager, and the Sri Lankans refused to destroy the homes of mounds of snakes. They refused because these are the creature's homes and this is wrong. And he writes about that. And I said, oh, okay, now I see how Buddhism kind of crept into his Christianity. And I really love what he's writing about, because he says that the only way we can overcome nature deficit disorder is basically through compassion. And there's been studies there of people who have ignored other people, who've gone through 8 weeks of mindfulness, and the growth of compassion and care has been measured about 61%. So think about all those folks who look at nature and think of it as an object and do terrible things to it, and how we really need to be thoughtful and mindful of what we're doing. And so under that kind of perspective, and Indigenous peoples see nature as their kin. Any Indigenous person that introduces themselves by the waters they live. They're their family. So when we commit ecocide against these, we're killing kin. And so it's not only ecocide, it's genocide in their minds. And so that's where my chapter on Standing Rock and Earth Rights came out of, and the Insurgency of the Spirit. Okay. Mona, did you have a question or comment?
No, someone I had put in the chat wanted to know the title of the book that you referenced a few slides back. And I think it was probably the book that you wrote, God is Green.
God is Green.
Yeah.
It's in the PowerPoint if you make it. And then if she or he Googles me, they'll find that the Insurgency of the Spirit, it's in hardback. It won't come out to paperback, and it's too expensive. Only libraries buy it at this point. But you can get it if you read Kindle books for $45, but don't get the hardback. The paperback should be out sometime in October or so.
On your website, I think there's some excerpts too from some of your writing, like some chapters, so people could go there and read more, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I really am committed to this, because I think that we've got to do something to save life in the earth. It's really important. And we're spending so much time in blocking it. We need to move away from an economy of destruction, a basically oil-based, and I know I'm committing a sin in Texas in terms of fossil fuels, but they're killing the planet, and we need to move to renewable energies, you know, and economies of life. It means major changes in our lives. And think of your grandchildren when you're doing so.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for being with us today. You've given us a lot to think about. I'm really going to ponder that term biomimicry. So I've got a new vocabulary word. So I'm going to play with that.
Get the Insurgency of the Spirit. Biomimicry is the ethics of Jesus that comes out of his learning from nature and creation-centered spirituality. And I rewrite the Beatitudes as echo Beatitudes. For instance, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The word meek in Greek is pros. apros meant murderer. So take that. Blessed, how basically not blessed are the murderers of the earth. It is those who live in meekness and humility with the earth that shall inherit it. So, you know, I did that with each of the echo of the Beatitudes in Matthew, and basically reformulated it. Jesus has a very environmental creation-centered spirituality that reflects the prophets, as well as the reading I did today, and basically Proverbs and so on, that reflects a beauty of really love of creation and fighting for justice for the earth.
Right. All right. Well, we'll read that in the Insurgence of the Spirit then.
Okay. Right,
Thank you. Okay. Thanks again for being with us. Thanks, everyone, for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, everyone. Blessings this day.
Blessings.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Have a great week, everybody.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.